let's go 50 years ago. 50 years ago, it's the global South that's galloping forward with an idea of economic decolonization, of national sovereignty. That's seen as a threat, certainly to Henry Kissinger, but seen as a threat to then what was conceived to be a true liberal, kind of almost capital L democracy, you know, because they wanted to do things that were seen as, expropriation. You know, this was a threat to a kind of regime of property protections.
During this period, a lot of these countries are starting to get seats in international organizations as well, right? It's like they get invited to the UN and stuff like that.
Yeah, exactly.
So there is this kind of creeping democratic threat. They're like, oh shit, these guys are going to have a voice in the stuff that we do pretty soon.
And what I'm, you know, one of the things I'm tracing in my academic research is the disappearance of that decolonization project. And what's replaced it instead, if you look at the discourse in the UN, the General Debate Corpus, for example, in the UN General Assembly, if you look at what they talk about in the Group of 77, for example, in the coordinating body of the Global South, they go from speaking in a protagonistic language of decolonization, of liberation, of freedom from domination, to speaking in a much more reactive language, defending multilateralism, protecting countries from these webs. And the same thing has happened in terms of liberal democracy. 50 years ago, it was the liberal Democrats who were trying to argue that we were the barbarians at the door, that these projects were, a threat to the democratic stability of these countries. And certainly that was the argument that was made against a lot of the social democratic governments in Latin America, for example. And now this weird thing has happened, where, as you say, the sort of so-called populist right, or I don't even know what to call them, they're such a cretinous, weird, monstrous thing, but and ideologically coherent.
That's how you really feel.
But they're the entrepreneurs. I mean, they're the ones
they're
who are
the
leading.
They're the political entrepreneurs.
And all of a sudden, it's the left who has become this reactive defender of a liberal democratic status quo.
And also, I think, made the rhetorical mistake of defending a lot of institutions that are not worth saving or so completely dysfunctional or like totally taken over by neoliberal interests that we sound kind of like the defenders of a system that's not working in many cases.
Totally. And, you know, I think part of this is such a dynamic question because it has to do a lot with the evolution of the left in certain places around the world and what they learn or what they fail to learn along the way. You know, when, in for example, large parts of the Global South, the left wins for the first time, they think, okay, you know, we did it.
Good news.
In all those cases, they're winning by two-thirds majorities.
Unheard of.
They think that, like, okay, well, we can now compete on the terms of this new democratic game. And because we're the ones who communicate and have emerged from the social base, the majority, and we're the ones who are marshaling and speaking for the social majority.
They're enacting the popular will.
Then how could we ever lose? And I think that there's still a sense of disbelief in large parts of the international left that can sometimes manifest as a kind of anger at their own electorate, you know? And it's like, how is it possible? How could we lose? How could you not, you know, see that we are? And I sometimes feel that too. But the reason why is, as you say, Josh, like the rules of the game are just changing. And so if you ask me, do I think liberal democracy has a future? I would say, I hope not. I mean, I hope that we can have a more honest conversation about the institutional order and the institutional architecture in these so-called democratic systems. I hope we can evolve past the sense that they were ever about the fair and even distribution of opportunities and privileges. They were always about protecting certain sectors, protecting certain classes, domestic or foreign, and not others.
Right.
And we
right.
can begin to speak about establishing new constitutional orders that are honest about their either redistributive intent downward or redistributive intent upwards. And so I think that the right has been, they've recognized more quickly that people are just not voting on abstract principles like liberal democracy anymore. They're voting on emotions, or they're voting on material. I'm not pretending like I have the answers to this, but people are not vote. You know, as we saw in the Kamala case, people are not voting on the defend democracy ticket?
Well, it's, so this is a subjective case. It depends on what your analysis is. My sense is that most people have a general idea about whether the existing status quo establishment structures are working in their interest or against them. And the ways in which that is expressed is by voting for an opposition candidate, an insurgent candidate. And people are open to, they're not especially ideological. If somebody from the outside on the right or outside on the left says, I'm going to fix these things, they're more likely to align with that person. But I don't think that people have a class consciousness that is just waiting to bubble to the surface, given them a bit of the right rhetoric. On this topic of rhetoric, so this gets to the role of media. I completely agree that I don't want to return to liberal democracy as the status quo, right? I wrote this thing a few months back where people are like, we need the liberal Joe Rogan, like all this bullshit. I was like, actually, liberalism is incredibly cruel and we're just watching its structural inequality now. That's what the problem is. So the way that I think you move the Overton window about what terms are even possible to discuss is through media, right? If anything, this is kind of the first wave of how things work their way into politics and policy. So I feel that liberalism generally has reached this kind of point of historical development where the only thing that it can deliver, as we have seen through all of these different cases of comparative governance, is like, we can give you social conservatism and neoliberal economics, or we can give you anarcho-capitalism. But they can't really give you much of anything else. Mm-hmm. So I guess the question is like, when is it okay, or when is it in our interest to just lead with the word socialism as compared to like holding up liberal norms?
So I want to, I think both of the points that you made can be answered. The point you made about anti-system politics and the point you're making about media can be answered helpfully by looking at the country where I've lived for a very long time, of Mexico. Mm-hmm. Mexico has been the site of what I believe is the most important innovation in political communication and media in the 21st century.
Yeah.
And that is a thing called the Mañanera.
Okay. Mañanera, tell us what that is.
Was established by Mexico, the first really left-wing government in Mexico in the 21st century, of Andrés Manuel López Obrador. Mm-hmm. AMLO, just like you said, AMLO is a shortening of his name, it was a guy who was all too aware of the hypertrophic power of corporate media domestically and of U.S. media internationally, mm-hmm. Even of the New York Times and the Washington Post, which were, you know, part and parcel of repeated electoral frauds that robbed him of the presidency in 2006, 2012, before he finally won in 2018. Mm-hmm. So what does AMLO do? He does two things. The first is the most important one, and the second one gets to your question. He establishes a daily press conference every single day from 7 a.m. oftentimes to 8 or 8:30, where he stands at the podium and has all the journalists who want to come sit in the audience. And he walks through the day's issue, walks through the news, gives his perspective, and then forces the media not to set the agenda for the government, but to respond to the agenda that he's setting from government.
So he became a daily Twitch streamer.
Exactly. Every morning.
Yeah.
And so for the rest of the day and the show,
they have to respond to him.
You joke. Claudia Sheinbaum today, the new president, who's continued this tradition of Mañanera, is the most watched YouTuber in Mexico.
Yeah.
So for the whole day, students, journalists, it's on the radio, it's on YouTube. Everyone is watching the Mañanera.
Yeah.
And every day they bring in a different member of the cabinet to speak to a different issue. Security, minimum wage, whatever it is. Mm-hmm. And he's also riffing. He's opining. He's making fun of journalists. He's not afraid of them.
Yeah.
He's bringing them up, humiliating them ritually, including the New York Times. And he's reasserting the power of the public, enshrined and embodied in the president, to set the terms of discourse, basically. So this was, you know, an incredibly important innovation. Because people are always struggling to understand, how do we battle back against that hypertrophy? How do we deal with the media? Mm-hmm. You deal with the media by beating them to that punch and structuring the communications. And I, you know, the same thing goes for Zoran Mamdani. If I have one recommendation for the comm strategy of Zoran, every day give a press conference.
Yeah.
Every single day, get in front of the message, get in front of the media. Why? Because then you can cut stories off. The stories don't bubble up. This is happening. That's happening. You go, this is what's really happening. And so even when you're failing, even when you want to do something and you can't for some reason.
Failing in policy.
In policy terms.
Yeah.
Right? To deliver on some promise.
Yep.
You're helping, you're explaining why.
What the hurdle is.
And this gets us to the point of how do you sustain an anti-system politics once you've won government?
Mm-hmm.
You do it by getting out there and saying, I would love to legislate for you. I'd love to raise minimum wage. But this person and that person and this person are blocking me.
I like this quite a bit. Yeah. So some of the, because we're behind the paywall now, so I would not say this publicly, but like, there, I've had a lot of conversations about like, what are the obstacles that Zohran is going to run into? They're significant in New York. There's a lot of very wealthy, very powerful people here. And if there is the perception among the public that he made all these big promises and then we can't get anything, that really damages the social democratic project in general, because it looks like we can't make good on our promises.
But it's a huge
opportunity. And so if you can control the narrative and be like, okay, it's literally this fucking billionaire who is obstructing this policy and I'm trying to give you these buses, but this guy is in the way, that is actually a very powerful position to be in.
And it's a project of political education. You get your public to understand the inner workings of City Hall and beyond. There is such a strange disease in US American politics. For some fucking reason, our members of Congress don't want the public to know what happens in Congress.
Well, I
mean, no one talks about it.
Seems like there's a lot of ritual child abuse going on, so they want to keep that.
Yeah. The sex cults and the corruption, for sure. Have you ever seen even, you know, a Bernie or an AOC, or let alone a Hakeem Jeffries, come out and say, this is what's happening in Congress. Like, we're fighting. This is the meeting I had today, and we this is who came out against us, and this, you know, this person called me.
No one,
for some reason, I mean, I think part of it is that, you know, people are so apathetic and cynical, they don't want to know, maybe. But, like, the basic work of political education is not being done in this country in a way where people see Congress as a giant black box for good reason. They're just not being told what happens. I don't know what happens in the Senate. I just don't know.
We only hear things like we're working tirelessly behind the scenes.
Yeah,
it's very, very opaque. Yeah.
And you know, you hear that and you're like, what are you doing actually? Show me the tireless work. Like,
yeah.
And so part of the money that I think is really helpful is that the other thing in Mexico that's important, and you know, I think the DSA is trying their hardest to do this, but Morena, which is a machine, actually did it. It's the starting Institute of Formation, Instituto de Formación de Morena.
Okay. And what is that?
Every candidate and field organizer has to go to basically school
to understand
the history of national popular struggles in Mexico, to understand, you know, the social movements that comprise the party, the trade unions that inform its policy. And it's a weak instrument. It's not like everyone, you know, when it is a very ideologically heterogeneous party, but it is a very, very helpful institution to kind of try to build out more of this, to your point about whether we talk in the language of socialism or not. I just think it's important for there to be a common vocabulary in general.
Yeah.
I don't get hung up really on these kinds of labels, especially in a country like this where it's like, in what world do we get socialism? I
mean,
calling yourself a socialist in the United States is like, calling yourself a fucking unicorn. It's like,
but
okay.
A little bit of like, I don't know, education, a shared canon of references, clarity on generally what the program can be.
And keeping people angry.
That's very important.
Keeping people angry. I mean, I think part of it is not, you know, the problem is, you know, people, there's, you can, you know, a Democrat wins and this, it's like, I don't have to think about this thing anymore.
I know.
Whatever, the high liberal class.
Yeah.
But like, people have to stay angry or whatever. Maybe anger, which I think is a helpful emotion, is too offensive to our compatriots. Stay motivated and, you know, to be clear-minded about the obstacles.
Yeah, I mean, you do see these things. There's events in the news cycle, and then you see membership to left-wing organizations surge or decline, right? And so there's like the depoliticizing effect.
You want to hear my big conspiracy theory? My big conspiracy theory about U.S. politics in the 21st century is that the two largest social movements in this country, which were, without a doubt, Me Too and Black Lives Matter, only happen because of the temporary alignment of left-wing causes and liberal anti-Trump partisanship, basically. And we know this because we know that everyone knew about Harvey Weinstein for fucking forever. I'm from LA. I know all about that shit. Black Lives Matter kicked off in 2014 in Ferguson. when Barack Obama was president, CNN, MSNBC, they squashed it. New York Times said that people were exaggerating the issues in Ferguson. What's different about 2016 and 2014? Trump is president, and it behooves these big liberal networks, and the Times and WAPO, et cetera, who are angry about Trump being president, to align themselves with the organic left-wing grievances and movements.
Yep. A way to counter-signal
Trump.
So
we had this explosion of social discontent because all of a sudden liberal media, favorable now to these liberal as a weapon against their partisan opponent, is able to unleash these social energies.
And then you end up in this very bizarre social environment in which people who were downwardly mobile and looking to counter-signal the status quo see this kind of alignment of progressive values and neoliberal economics and somehow get in their 15-year-old meme-poisoned mind that the Trump administration is their kind of countercultural political affiliation. It's beautiful, and it's worked out wonderfully.
Totally. I think it's, you don't have to be a conspiracist to see that, like, you know, these progressive causes were really perverted by that temporary alignment. And giving a really false image to really good organizers, and serious activists, that they could rely on a traitorous class, which is the kind of high liberal DNC class. I mean, no one knows how to stab someone in the back like a Democrat.
I couldn't agree more. The last thing I'll ask you on this topic, I'm very much in favor of this system you've described of, like, basically holding a press conference every day, of being the source from which news stories emanate outward from, rather than responding to whatever the media wants from you that week. Is there some component of attention economy at work here where one could imagine, let's say, a more conspiratorial, nationalist-leaning party using those same technical tools and, like, poisoning the airwaves with different types of narratives, right? Like, there are some stories that, because of their mimetic, very transmittable nature, spread more easily, right? Sensationalism, outrage, all the things that are privileged on social media. What is it in your mind that prevents those same tools from being turned over into a right-wing political instrument?
Absolutely nothing. I mean, Donald Trump, if AMLO is an entrepreneur in public communications, Donald Trump on the other side of the border is just as much so. I mean, this guy
is
a great poster. I mean, talk about, you know, mimetic and transmissible and infectious and dangerous kind of communication. So they're already doing this. My argument is not that these things are innovative in the sense that they've never been tried before. They're innovative in the sense that they are new to a space that has been otherwise allergic to more muscular forms of public communication.
So it's actually an argument that because it could be potentially more easily turned into a right-wing political tool, we then have to do it anyway,
right?
Because they're advantaged by using it, so we have to kind of keep pace.
Media is an inherently right-wing tool by the concentration of its ownership and profit-making nature.
Sure, yeah.
There's no way around that.
Right. But in the particular way that it's constructed now, there's affordances
under capitalism, which is to say, as long as we will be alive.
But even in a harmonious utopian socialism, there are just stories like gossip that spread person to person more quickly versus the slow, deliberate raising of class consciousness, right? Like, capital circulates a lot slower than, like, a piece of gossip that I'm going to tell you that's conspiratorial or sensational.
Yeah, but I think that there is always something sensational about efforts to sabotage.
Hi, everybody. This is Joshua Citarella. What you just heard is an excerpt from this week's bonus episode. If you want to hear more and get access to the full catalog for Doomscroll and other podcasts, you can support the show on Patreon or Substack, where I'm putting out new episodes every week. This is an independent show. I don't do any advertising, so your support is really what keeps this project going. Thanks for listening. See you again soon.